Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I am always so excited to have another conversation with my guest co-host, Greg Fuqua. And today we're going to talk about three different subjects that many of you are probably dealing with or have dealt with before you realize that one or maybe even both of you were neurodivergent. So the three topics we're going to address today are unidentified autism, monotropism, and PDA. Some people call that pathological demand avoidance. I hate that term.
All right.
I prefer pervasive demand for autonomy or demand for autonomy. And so I'd love, Greg, if since you were an unidentified autistic, I think it would be awesome if you could start kind of sharing a little bit about how that played out for you and your family and you and your wife or whatever you want to share.
Absolutely. Yeah. My pleasure again to be with you too. Again, Mona. Yeah. This is tricky for obviously for couples, but also the unidentified person to sort of get there. Now, it took me 40 some years to get there, you know, and I think part of the issues that go along with this is, and I see this in all of my clients and all the people I work with, including myself, is again, deficits in knowing how you're perceived and what I call certain gaps in identity. So, you know, I've talked about this before where I often ask my clients, particularly my younger clients, what does it mean to you to be autistic? And one of the common answers I get, now this, I think this is a very important question because we have to define and identify ourselves and to be able to see ourselves, right? And also that this is a very individual experience. But a lot of the answers I get is, I don't know, I'm just myself. Right? And so,
yeah.
And there's also this sort of paradox where a lot of autistics really believe they really know themselves. And because, you know, autism's, you know, root word in Greek is self, you know, it's this internalization, this retreat into self in some ways. And so we do have fairly intimate relationship with ourselves, but that also creates deficit in how we're perceived and disconnection from the world. And again, it's a protective mechanism too, to retreat into ourselves. And it creates some gaps in understanding who we are. And I think that, and plus the understanding of it is changing and the education and awareness around it is changing, you know, but my wife figured it out before I did. I did have obviously my son in front of me who is on the spectrum in ADHD to help with that process a little bit. But it really did take a lot to get there. And what's crazy about that is that even now, years into my identification is I continually have to get solid about, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. And it's a process. It is hard to get there, but I will tell you this, that getting there has been life-changing, has been beautiful in terms of how it has radically and more healthily changed the relationship with myself and empowered me as an individual in the world and in my relationships.
That's phenomenal. That's so wonderful. And, I hear both from, the non-autistic and the autistic partners in the couples group that it has, changed both of their experiences in their marriage. But, for some, there's so much pain and so much unintentional hurt that went on. And that's the story of my marriage, I feel. We were both very much in love with each other, and I've said this many times on the podcast. We went to the court and set, stood in front of a judge, still in love with each other, still loving each other, still caring about each other, and then walking out of the courthouse divorced. And so, the unidentified autism, and I'm going to say my unidentified ADHD, created so many challenges. And I know something probably the listeners want to know is, how do you look at those situations or challenges from the past now that one of you or both of you recognizes you're neurodivergent? How do you look at them through a different lens? And so, you totally get it. And I want to share a few things that I have looked at through a different lens. And again, I wish that we had had this lens earlier. And, I'm often asked, do you think that you would have stayed married? I don't know. There's no way to know that. But again, I say this too, we would have caused each other a lot less unintentional hurt and pain. And so, knowing communication differences, knowing that your partner who wants to talk to you, and I'm going to say that would be me, he wants to talk to you about, your day or wants to emotionally connect with you on the regular, every day, and wants to hear about your feelings in your life, and you're not getting that emotional reciprocity, and you take it personal. That can be, that can hurt so much when you want to socialize and you want to go to family events and you want to stay and have fun and laugh and all these things, and you find that your partner, wants to leave early. And again, you don't understand when, you're raising your kids and there's all kinds of sensory issues that are bombarding your partner and they don't know that they're overloaded and overwhelmed, and they might shut down or melt down, start screaming, or just, leave the party or the event. And you're like, oh my gosh, that's so rude. And so, those are just a few of the things, right, Greg? And one of the things I hear often from folks is, if I know or if I think that my partner is autistic or autistic ADHD, is it okay for me to say something? And I want to say, don't do it how I did it. And that was screaming at my ex-husband at the top of my lungs that, he was having a meltdown. And I said, I think that you have Asperger's. That's the word I used at the time. And we got into probably the biggest fight we'd ever gotten into in our marriage.
Oh, God, yeah.
So what are your thoughts about what I just shared?
Yes. So you're absolutely right that having the lens, being able to make sense of what's going on, knowing the whys behind why things are hard, where are the points of disconnection, where we're not aligned, where we don't get each other. You need the lens. You absolutely need to know the whys. And, part of the problem is, and I just talked to, a client about this, is the stigma. When his wife brought up the issue, he was like, I'm not dumb. I don't look like this, right? It's all the baggage. And so we really do have to soften our entry points into the discussion. It has to be led with a lot of care and love and curiosity and opposing the possibility and knowing and trying to rework or frame what that means in a different way. Again, diagnosis and understanding have come so far. you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the education around it is important, but if you have a partner who wants to grow, who wants that connection, who's open to self-reflection and to the possibility, you are in a good position. And again, I have to, you know, navigate these issues quite frequently, and sometimes it goes very well, and sometimes it doesn't at all. But I think it does take a kind and gentle approach, and of pushing in there in ways that can be tolerated, you know, and that rework how we see what it means to be neurodivergent. And to me, I am proud to be who I am. In fact, I know myself better now, and I'm on my outside better because I've embraced that, you know, and because I've also loved myself. You know, I in some levels, I love my autism, you know, and that's a really hard place to get, because a lot of autistics have a very negative motivational narrative about themselves in the world, you know, and so to create more curiosity and compassion, these are big shifts in understanding yourself. And so, you know, sometimes we do need to take it quite gently, quite carefully, and it's a process, you know, like I told you, even it's taken me years and years to get more and more solid about this. And again, it's because a lot of those gaps and not understanding how I'm perceived, not quite knowing myself. And that's going to be a work in progress. It isn't just a switch, but, when you can get there, I think it is a beautiful thing, and it can be super helpful. So, you know, and one way to do this is, again, if your partner wants to grow with you and recognizes there are things that aren't working, is to get into therapy. You know, a lot of times my couples come in and then I say, you know what, it might be better if I just work with one of you and then bring the other in as we need in terms of support and deepening understanding and collaboration and what we're working with. And, you know, that also creates maybe some more safety, but getting a good therapist or coach in front of you, in front of both of you, to help you navigate it can also diffuse what it might be, a lot of that pain and baggage and frustration and defensiveness and protectiveness that's on both sides.
I couldn't agree more. And that's why, you know, when you feel a disconnect with your therapist or your coach and they do not understand neurodivergence, run, run as fast as you can. And that's not to put down any therapist or coach who isn't aware of neurodivergence, but you know, the harm that that can cause is serious. If the therapist or coach wants to learn and do their own research, and they will be neuroaffirming and they will create a safe place, I'm all for that. Cause I think every therapist and coach out there who's working with humans needs to understand neurodivergence. But you know, that's not where we are as a society and as, you know, mental health providers and coaches. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've realized, because, and I've said this many times on the podcast, pretty much every man that I've dated has been neurodivergent. What I realize is that for me, it didn't matter whether they knew or not. Some knew and, you know, some didn't, and some may never acknowledge it. And so I think it's important to ask yourself, if you're the non-autistic, why is it so important for your partner to identify as autistic? Because what Greg talked about, the stigma and how behind we are in acknowledging the strengths and all the positives of neurodivergence, the feeling of inadequacy or being less than or broken could create, you know, mental health challenges for your partner. So I think we have to ask ourselves that. Why is it so important that our partner identifies or goes for an assessment or an evaluation? And for me, you know, I pushed my ex-husband to go. He went to see a psychologist who basically said to him, yeah, you're probably on the spectrum, but so what? Which was not the right thing to say, right? So why was it so important for me that he get diagnosed? And I will tell you, and I've never talked about this on the podcast, because I needed a reason for why we had had all these disconnections, misunderstandings, and challenges. And that was not the only reason. You know, we both came in with our trauma. We both came in being very codependent. But I thought that the neurodivergence or autistic lens would solve so many problems. And I'm sure there's many listeners who think that. And I think what might even be more important for folks to consider is how you can approach your partner in a kind and compassionate way about what you are feeling and needing. So for me, in that situation where my ex was melting down and he was just like, and he was pacing and he seemed almost like a caged animal. It was very, very disturbing for him and for me, but in very different ways. I could have said to him, I see that you're struggling. Mm-hmm. How can I create, you know, safety for you, or what can I do? What do you need? Or do you just need time alone? And I know that he probably just needed time alone. I needed to leave. We were away for the weekend. I needed to just walk out and give him space. But I was so worked up by watching him go through this. And I think if we can be self-aware and share with our partners what it is maybe we're feeling or needing at certain times when we're not getting what we think we should be getting because we came into the relationship thinking we were going to have, you know, the reciprocity or the communication or the socializing or whatever that we've seen in movies or read in books, or, you know, we saw our, you know, best friends have, whatever. I think that is very helpful. And I've done it in every relationship since. Doesn't mean your partner is going to want to embrace their neurodiversity. But as Greg said, if you have a partner who's willing to hear you and listen and learn about how you can each support each other and meet, you know, the needs that need to be met in an intimate, you know, partner relationship, then there's room for hopefully healing and growth. What do you think?
I think you're right. You know, again, identification, your identity and how you see yourself is yours, right? You know, and again, it may take a long time to get there, you know, and you can't define that for somebody else. You know, you can't say this is your identity and this is who you are. They have to kind of get there on their own. There is a lot of things you can do from your side. Now, there's danger here too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe, you know, you're lifting and doing all the workload, both for you and your growth and the education to understand your partner and the bridging around that in the relationship, right? And then what are they doing?
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of generosity in you doing that, but that's when you have to start sharing how you've been educating yourself, sharing your resources, you know, maybe talking about autistic traits instead of being autistic, or, you know, or talking about neurodivergency instead of using the word autistic. You know, I mean, what ways can we soften, open up, you know, the bridges we want in order to help, you know, and so this is really important too, because I think at some level, both partners do have to be growing individually together, if that makes sense.
Totally.
And so if one partner is growing, they're like, okay, I know this relationship is tough, and they are they're doing a lot of work on their own too. They're recognizing, okay, how have I contributed to this dynamic? And what have I done that's not so unhealthy? And what's been frustrating? And they're thinking about their partner too. And their partner is like, not doing any of that. Right. Mm-hmm. And, basically, you know, you've got a gap that's growing. And mm-hmm. this gap is this other person is rising up and growing. This other person is staying down on their level. And I don't care what pace either of you are growing, but you both need to grow. Yeah. The other person could be growing much, much slower. But as long as they're growing, that's okay. It's just that when that gap gets big enough between your growth and the other person's non-growth or resistance to growth, that at some point will end the relationship. It becomes untenable. There's too much resentment, right? If I'm lifting all this weight, I'm doing all the work, and the other person is it. So you at least on a baseline, as you said, sort of need some openness and willingness to start doing their own work. And I did my own work for a long time before, you know, I figured it out too. So it is a process for people, and you have to let people have their own journey.
Yeah. I agree. And I always tell couples, you know, to think about what are the three most important things that you want in your intimate relationship. And for me, in my marriage, I wanted a lot of quality time and I wasn't getting it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted mm-hmm. that physical intimacy. I'm not talking about sex on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't getting it. And I wanted, you know, a different style of communication, you know, and when neither one of us knew how to emotionally regulate our nervous system, it was very difficult. So, you know, and I've talked about this before, Greg, I had emotional affairs. I didn't have, you know, physical affairs, but I had mm-hmm. men in my life who were friends and I was mm-hmm. going to them for emotional reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I, in the beginning, I didn't see anything wrong with that. But then I realized this is not appropriate. And that's when I asked for a separation. And we did end up separating because I knew if that's what I was feeling, that I couldn't get the emotional reciprocity, the communication, the quality time, and the physical connection that I was looking for on a regular basis with my ex-husband, then I needed to separate. And, you know, we ended up divorcing after 2 years, 2.5 years of separation. But I think you're absolutely right about the growth part for both partners. And I hear this so often in my support groups that oftentimes it's the non-autistic partner feels they're doing all the work. But I want to caution the non-autistic partners because what Greg said, the speed at which your autistic partner might be growing may be so different than you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for you to check in with yourself and say, can I be patient? Can I treat them with love and compassion? Because if you can't, that's not fair. That's not fair. It's probably time for the relationship to end or to be in a different container. You know, I know a lot of neurodiverse couples who live separately. And then mm-hmm. they date, you know, they date yep. even if they're married, right?
Yep, yep.
So looking at other options, because my mission is to help reduce the pain, the emotional pain and misunderstanding that so many neurodiverse couples have, you know, once they realize they're a neurodiverse couple, but you can't change the past. So you have to be willing to change how you treat each other currently in the present and in the future, right?
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. I really appreciate, yeah, just your dialogue on, again, the reemphasis of, you know, each person has their own human journey and we have to respect that. We have to be kind toward that. We do have to have some patience around that. We have to recognize that our journeys can look very different, have very different paces. And so, you know, all I would say is to partners out there that have identified their partner as possibly or likely on the spectrum or neurodivergent, I just want to give you a lot of kudos, you know, because you care. You do want to understand this, you know, you are doing the work to figure this out. And I all I can do is applaud you and appreciate you and appreciate the ways in which you're working for each other, you know, and keep using that, hopefully without getting too parentified in the relationship. And also knowing your boundaries, knowing what's yours, knowing what's theirs, you know, which goes back to that individual growth piece too. And yes, creative and unusual solutions are okay. There isn't a norm that needs to be applied to neurodiverse relationships. There needs to be openness in terms of how we can make this work or what does it need to look like for us.
Yeah. 100% agree. And, you know, I'm going to recommend that if you think that your partner might be autistic or neurodivergent, maybe after you listen to this, send it to them. You know, they can listen in and hear some of the things we're talking about. And this is a perfect segue to the next topic that we want to talk about, and that is monotropism. And normally I don't give definitions on the podcast, but I wanted to give one for monotropism because it isn't a term that's used a lot. I mean, we've talked about it a few times. I've talked about it a few times with you and other guests, but I think it's really important to understand what the definition is. And I got this definition from the Stimpunks Foundation. That's STIMPUNKS Foundation. And I really love their website. And they have a questionnaire on there for monotropism too. It's 47 questions. So if anybody's interested. So monotropism is a person's tendency to focus their attention on a small number of interests at any time, tending to miss things outside the attention tunnel. So we hear about, you know, special interests and passions, and they're often things that are in an autistic person's life or a neurodivergent's life for a reason. Not only is it their passion, but it also can help with kind of self-regulating. It's the comfort zone. But also I want to talk about three things that I think are really positive about monotropism. And then I would love to hear your thoughts. Monotropism lends itself to intense experiences, deep thinking, and flow states.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
So,
Greg, it's all yours.
Oh, yeah. So this is what's great about the monotropism as a theory is that it's very balanced. It's not just a deficit orientation of understanding what it means to be autistic. It also identifies all these strengths that are components of it too. And I think that's very healthy and something that we need to do with neurodivergence and autism in general. You know, so two things that kind of happen with monotropism that can create problems is first is, like you said, since monotropism is sort of more the singular focus and a singular focus with depth, it creates more opportunities for context blindness, okay? That is for tracking the rest of the things that are going on around you or the nuance or the agendas or the unspoken messages that are in the background too, you know? And this is also what creates problems with sometimes navigating social situations is, you know, I remember people used to ask me, hey, Greg, how you doing? And I would answer them like with depth, you know, well, you know, I didn't sleep very well last night and I'm kind of stressed out about this. And then they start rolling their eyes, shake their head and walk away. And so I didn't get the context for which that was happening. It was just a point of quick superficial connection, right?
Right.
And so I could focus on the content of the words and what that meant, but I couldn't focus on why it was done or what was the rest of it surrounding it, right? And it also explains a lot about why emotionality tends to overwhelm or short circuit the autistic brain. Emotions have depth, they have feelings, they have energy, they have tension, they have also context, history, baggage, thinking, all kinds of things are affected. It's a totally overwhelming thing. Imagine that, pairing that up with a bunch of content and meaning too, right? So when you're talking to me, I could focus on the meaning, the content of your words very well. If that starts to ramp up emotionally, there is one or the other that I can focus on, but not both. And then suddenly I'm lost and I feel threatened in that moment, you know, and overwhelmed. I think another big point of where monotropism can create some problems in the relationship too is also this autistic inertia, you know, which I call sort of, you know, stuckness, which is getting into this thing that kind of overwhelms or dominates, you know, and the difficulty of interrupting that. So, right, the definition of inertia is, you know, an object in motion wants to stay in motion unless an outside force affects it, right? Well, the outside force that affects us tends to be very disruptive because we are in inertia. You know, we are in, and so that term of the flow state, I am like, yes, right? Yeah. And of course, I worked as an artist for many, many years, and feeling that flow state, being connected to myself, finding a sense of belonging and safety in myself was a wonderful tool, as you said, for regulation, but also can contribute to disconnection, context blindness, and other issues, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, I think this is why the reason we paired these topics together is I think sometimes in relationships, you may notice that there's a lot of time spent on what you would normally call a hobby, right? And your partner seems to go to that hobby often when it might be more appropriate for them to have a conversation with you or for them to engage with your children or for them to go to work, you know, or whatever. And so this could be a point of hopefully positive conversation. I notice that when we're having an emotional conversation, you seem to veer off to the garage to work on your car, or, you know, you seem to go to the gym or whatever. You know, tell me a little bit about what's going on or how this conversation is, you know, making you feel, or how come we're not able to connect. And again, these might be conversations that you can start together, but you probably are going to need the help of a coach or a therapist to move forward. I'm thinking. The other thing with monotropism is, you know, like Greg was talking about, you know, your partner might feel socially like they only want to talk about the things that are important to them. I remember my ex saying to me during our separation, he said, "I only want to talk about the things that are important to me, and I don't want to hear about anything that isn't. I don't want to have conversations with anybody that is not interested in the things I'm interested in." Oh my gosh, I started crying and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, and I said to him, I said, "I don't care what the topic of conversation is with people that I care about. I want to hear about their interests. I want to know what they think or how they feel. And I want to engage in conversation around it." He goes, "Nope, not me." Well, that was a shock because for 30 years, I had been talking about my interests. I had been talking about my emotions, and he had been sitting there listening, at least I thought. And, you know, maybe for 30 years, he didn't want to have anything to do with any of those conversations. So maybe I overloaded him for, you know, most of the time we were married. I don't know. But I'm sharing that with a laugh because I think if you're in a relationship with somebody you care about, monotropism can be challenging because your partner does want to engage with you and not just about the things that you care about. So being able to create that balance, right, Greg?
Yes. And this is something you have to work on. You know, I love,
Yes.
you know, the way you're describing that this is a good point of negotiation. Number one, let's recognize and celebrate how important that special or deep interest is for that person, what that does for them, you know. So let's validate that instead of make it a problem, number one, you know.
Right.
And let's say, you know, hey, love the fact that, you know, you need to go to your space, your studio, your garage, whatever it is, your hobby is, and do your thing. And I want to give you some space for that. Let's negotiate how much of that you need and when you can come out, you know. So basically it's sort of giving some of that power and autonomy to the neurodivergent person to recognize it, not be just ripped out of this place or shamed about it, but negotiated in terms of, you know, creating a lot of empathy and importance around it, and then asking them to shift. Because if we can shift on our own, you know, things go so much more smoother and we feel better about it. Because, you know, this is probably a really perfect segue into demand avoidance, which we're
right,
going to talk about in a second. But capacity and stress also impacts how monotropic your partner may be. So they may feel they need this retreat or this place to go to connect with themselves much more. It can also read, as you've described, almost like narcissism. I care about my stuff and I don't have room for other stuff or for those extras. And so a lot of my work is increasing awareness of stress, of chronic stress on the neurodivergent mind and experience, and expanding people's capacities so they have more ability to transition, to create points of connection. And with my wife and I, then this goes back to our communication workbook too. There are exercises and tools in there to help you guys practice those connections of asking the questions, of having emotional boundaries as you're communicating, and but also finding emotional connection, you know. And when you're able to do that as a neurodivergent person, it feels really good. It's really hard at first. It can be really overwhelming. It takes a lot of effort, but when you start getting it and figuring it out, you know, this is another thing, is that autistics love deep connection, really. So if we're able to do that with our partners in ways that work for us and ways that we can deepen our skills in, to me, it's been a positive emotional boon, you know, in a way that has really helped me, has really helped my partnership and marriage.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, and I notice, you know, with the men that I've dated who are autistic, some are autistic ADHD, when they are able to share with me their passions, they can go on for, you know, a half hour, an hour. It becomes kind of a monologue, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, Greg, it's a turn on. You know, when somebody is, to me, is that passionate about something that they want to share it with me. And that is one of their love languages, you know, to be able to info dump. And so I embrace it, and I am a perpetual learner. Now, I may be different than a lot of the listeners. I do want to hear about my partner's, you know, deep passions and interests. And I then also want to ask questions. So I also want to caution couples out there, because it's not just about sharing, it's about a dialogue. So if I have questions about your special interest or your passion, I really would like you to answer them. I really would like us to have a dialogue. And please don't look down on your partner because they know nothing about your interests, right? Because I never wanted to be looked down upon, but I think I was in my marriage, because technologically I have no skills, which still amazes me that I've done a podcast for 3.5 years, but I've increased my skills a little bit. But I often felt like I was looked down upon because I didn't understand the passions that my ex had for music and technology. And I don't think I ever will. But gosh, did I love hearing him talk about all of those things that he was passionate about. And I feel the same way with every person that I've been in a relationship with. Yeah. Friend or intimate partner. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's one way that obviously that you have a great match and dynamic with probably autistics, in that my wife's the same way. She's a wonderful listener, you know, wonderful listener. And autistics want to be understood. We want to be heard. And when you join us with that, it really fills our bucket, you know? And so, and so what I often tell my autistic sides of my couples is, notice how that feels to you when you're really heard, when you're really understood, when you know they're getting it and they've joined you there. Don't you want to give that back to them too? Right.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Because that's that ritual of communication, of emotional connection that we have in the workbook, or the microphone exercise is a really good example of when you practice these things and you know you've been heard, you know you've been seen, and you know they've got it right, it really calms your system down. It really feels good.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, like, that's a turn on, you know. And Greg is talking about the communication workshop that we did, and the recording is available. And you can go to my website, Neurodiverse Love, and go to the shop, and you can see the recording for the communication workshop. It's only $97. And with the workshop, you get the workbook that we created, which includes all the exercises that Greg is talking about. It was a little over 2 hours, and it was, I think, a phenomenal discussion. And it's so wonderful to have both of our perspectives on these issues. And as you can see, we're very transparent and open about the mistakes that we made and the challenges we had and how we've grown. And I know both of us are always going to be a work in progress. All of us are on this earth. So we're never going to probably stop learning. And, you know, I don't know if you have anything else you want to share about monotropism before we go on to how PDA might be impacting a relationship.
No, I think, again, I think monotropism is a good way to understand and explain a lot of what happens in terms of processing preference and needs for the neurodivergent partner or the autistic partner. I don't think it explains everything, but I think it does explain a lot. And I think demand avoidance, as I sort of touched on, and the acronym PDA, right, is what's used, with its pathological demand avoidance. I'd take away the pathological for sure. But there's also PDAs, the persistent demand for autonomy, is also a very, it's a better way of sort of seeing it, you know. And before I knew these terms, I was describing it to my clients as stress aversion and avoidance. Because I think it does overlap, in as all autistic traits are amplified by stress, you know. So your capacity makes, you know, again, when you're low capacity and you're high stress and you don't have a lot of room for extra, that demand avoidance or the need for autonomy is going to go up, and as a trait in your partner. And so, as we talked about, that negotiation around the tendency of autistic inertia and to get stuck in your special interest and to be sort of your default, and to give room for somebody to make that transition themselves, really speaks to this idea of the need for autonomy, and also the resistance to being placed as a demand, like, you need to do this. This is what it needs to look like, right? So it really does need to be a negotiation, and the more power or space you can give somebody to do that on their own, and more likely we'll be able to do that. And we see this as approach often with kids on the spectrum as well.
Right. I know. And, you know, looking back again at my marriage, I can remember so many times where I would ask my ex to do something and he would say, yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
And it wouldn't get done, right? Or I'd ask him to make a decision and he'd go, okay, and it wouldn't come. And I, again, we can both laugh about it now, but in the moment, it is extremely painful. And, I went to judgment, I went to anger, I went to, usually some emotional screaming or whatever, or pushback. And now, I understand PDA in a way that, again, I wish I had before. And I give such flexibility now in relationship that, I never thought I would be able to do this, right? Because I want decisions made quickly. I want my partner to say yes when we've both agreed to something. I want them to follow through. I think one of the biggest issues for me in my marriage, Greg, was the lack of follow through. And right, and believing in my ex's word and trusting him, right? I'm hitting some big issues. And I remember saying to him at the end of our separation, I no longer trust you. I no longer respect you. And I no longer can believe your word, right? So I think that throughout our marriage, I demanded so much in such an unhealthy, say unsafe way, that I probably triggered his PDA every day or most every day, right? And yeah, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I mean that really hit me.
Okay. Which part of it?
Oh, just the, I don't trust you, I don't trust your word, I don't respect you, I so appreciate you, Mona, because I know you are giving me that too in our interactions outside the podcast, in terms of the scheduling, in terms of what you're doing. I feel that space from you. And it's so helpful. And it's also helpful in the way that you do believe in me. And again, this I think this overlaps into a lot of stuff related to unidentified autism and how to approach and understand your partner and their neurodivergence. So here's an example of PDA in me that happened just 2 weeks ago. Okay. So my wife enters the room and I'm sitting down. I don't know what I was doing. I was just sitting down and she goes, "Hey, honey, can you call Lowe's and have them come over and measure our floors so we can get an estimate on, what we need to do with our floors?" And I could feel it in my system. And what it felt like is resistance. It just felt like tension in my chest. And in that moment, there's no way I could say yes. So she's looking at me and she's saying, "Now I know you've got, the product we're thinking about. I know you got the number. So if you could call them and have them schedule it, that'd be great." And I'm just staring at her saying, and I know inside I'm going, "I cannot say yes. I cannot say yes. If I say yes, I'm not going to do it." And so I cannot say yes. And she's just, so I'm blankly staring at her. She's staring at me. She turns around and leaves the room. Okay. And we've had to negotiate this before. So I talked about it later, if I would have said yes, I wouldn't have been able to do it. Because it would have felt like a betrayal to my system. I literally couldn't say yes. And it wasn't voluntary. I wanted to do it. This is the crazy thing. I wanted to do it, but the demand was placed upon me and I couldn't. And so this is how we've negotiated it in the past, is I say, "Honey, if you tell me to do something, okay, it's easier for me to not answer or to say no. And if you allow me to do that, I will likely do it. Know that you're being heard and that I will likely do it." Okay. And that has actually helped quite a bit. And that's why she gave up and just turned around and walked out of the room, because she knew, again, we'd negotiated this in the past. She knew I'd heard her. She knew I would probably do it. but I couldn't give her the yes answer. And so it's the best way I can describe what happens internally for us. You know, it's literally not voluntary. It's like energy in my system is like, absolutely not, you know, and it's not voluntary. It's not a choice. There isn't space there to say yes. And in fact, saying yes would ruin it, you know. And I had one of my clients say this to me. They said, "Greg, I'm scared to tell you about the good stuff I'm doing." I was like, "Oh, why?" "Because I'm afraid you're going to tell me to keep doing it, and then it will ruin it." And I'm like,
"Wow."
And so now I know, you know, all the time, I'm like, you know, I never tell her to keep doing it. I just say, "Wow, that's wonderful," or "That's so creative," or "That is so cool." Just affirmational words. No expectations, no extra demands, no extra pressure, right?
Yeah. That is such a fantastic example. And I'm sure those folks who are listening are going to be like, "That's exactly what happens in my household."
Right.
And Greg, I will tell you again, this was a conversation with my ex during our separation, and it might have even been in therapy. He said something like, "I say no to you now because you have expectations and demands of me that I can never meet. And so the easiest thing for me to do is just say no all the time." And whoo, did that hit hard. I was like, "Are you kidding me? You aren't even going to be open. You are just going to say no to everything." I mean, we were, you know, separated at the time, but I don't think he fully understood how that hit for me, that the times you've said yes, when really you knew you weren't going to do it, even though you might want to, you weren't being honest with me. You weren't being honest with yourself. And so what you did is you created a minefield where I'm going to explode every time you do something that I'm trusting, or you don't do something I'm trusting you to do. And then you become untrustworthy in my book.
Right.
And that was exactly what happened and led to our divorce. Greg, I don't think I've ever talked about this in this depth on the podcast, and this is going to be a light bulb moment for a lot of folks. If you are, I'm going to say this from love. If you are the autistic partner in your relationship and you have experiences like Greg described with his wife regarding Lowe's, find a time and place where you are calm to be able to explain to your partner what is happening to you in your mind and your body, or share this podcast. Because if my ex had been able to tell me that, and he had been able to say, "Mona, when you ask me to make a decision on the spot, I get so dysregulated, I get so anxious, I get so nervous that I'm going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, that I'm not going to be able to meet your expectation, that I'm not going to be able to follow through in the timeline you want, that I get so discombobulated that I don't respond, or I say yes to please you, and I know I'm not going to do it."
Yep.
I would have said, "Okay, how can we work through that? Do we go to therapy? What do we do?" Right. You know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you're absolutely right with all that, you know. And so why it's so important to talk about process. I couldn't say what was going on in that moment, but we had bridged that afterwards several times in the past. So even though I could tell it was unresolved and a little bit frustrating for my wife, we had a trust there, meaning she was able to walk away, you know, and, you know, I was able to do it. And then we were able to talk about what happened. So talking about intent, talking about process, that is what's going on inside of you. And this is why awareness is the number one skill for self growth, you know, And also having, obviously, the safety to be able to say, this is what happens to me. It's weird. I don't know quite how to explain it. You know, it is, maybe you don't think it's normal or right, you know. We have to let ourselves have the space to do this if we want a chance to bridge and be more connected and understood between our neurotypes. We have to.
Amen. I so agree with you. Again, it would have created so much more calm in my marriage if I had understood this and known it. And, you know, like you said, the conversations you and I have, whether they're talking with each other or in email, I respect this piece and I understand it in a way I never did before. And I think that so many people are struggling and suffering because they don't understand it.
Right.
And maybe, again, these are not conversations you can have alone, and you need a coach or a therapist. And of course you can reach out to Greg. But if you do not have these conversations, if you do not understand what's going on, I guarantee that you will continue to suffer and there will be more conflict and anger. And one of the things that I've learned, Greg, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is when I want something from my partner who is autistic ADHD, I communicate very differently when I know what I want. In the past with my ex-husband, I knew what I want. I told him what I wanted, usually in a kind, loving way, sometimes forceful, but usually I tried to be kind and loving and just expected a response. Yes, I can do it, or no, I can't. And, you know, if he said no, fine. If he said yes, then I wanted him to follow through. So now what I'll do is I'll put options out there. And I did this with my daughter and didn't even realize what I was doing. And what I will do is I'll say, you know, I'd really love for us to go out for dinner. Are there any new restaurants you want to try, or any new place, or any places that you really want to go to, any places that you like? What day would work for you? Is there a particular day? Are there days that are no longer good for you this week? And, you know, is there a time that works better for you? And then being flexible, this was a big one for me, Greg, being flexible when a time is set and my partner's late because of whatever, but I'll get the text that says, my estimated time of arrival, my ETA is, and, you know, I'll get the map or whatever, so I know that he's on the road. And I respect that and I value that. And I've had to adjust where I normally expect almost everybody else in my life to be on time. You know, I have to be a little bit more flexible. And I don't take it personal anymore, or personally anymore, where I did in my marriage, because my ex was late almost all the time. He was late. For him to be on time was like, that was a major act or achievement. And so, you know, if you can't be flexible and you can't have some, you know, grace for your partner in this area, you gotta kind of look at, you know, is this the right partner for you? Because it's going to be a challenge as you move forward if you can't have some grace and some wiggle room.
Yeah, and diffusing the pressure will actually create the ability to meet you easier for your autistic partner that has demand avoidance or need for autonomy. And so giving that choices, giving that flexibility, and giving options, like you said, a wonderful way of thinking about it. Making your partner, your neurodivergent partner, feel good about their efforts and what they're doing, and giving, again, if words of affection, appreciation are their love language, which for many of us it is, because we have, you know, rejection sensitivity and recognition euphoria, then do that too. You know, I think I may have told this story once before, but I think it's really a good one and very applicable both to parents with neurodivergent kids and for partners. And so my son, who's ADHD and on the spectrum, you know, he he would like leave a mess wherever he was at. You know, he would kind of live in a situation, and there would be wrappers and glasses and cups and, you know, napkins, and it would just like surround that area he was hanging out for him. And then of course he would move on to the next thing, and then not deal with it. And so I'd be like, Jaden, can you pick up all your shit in the other room, you know? And he'd be like, yeah, you know. And and then 5 minutes later he'd go up to his room. And I'd be like, okay, that didn't work. And I'm like, I think I need to be more accurate about how I feel about him, and what, you know, and how to ask him how to do it. So I thought, and again, these strategies are also in the workbook. And I said to him, hey, Jaden, love you, buddy. I really respect, appreciate everything you're doing. You're working hard at your job and at school. Really appreciate it. So when you have time and when you have a moment, get a chance, we just pick up that stuff you left in the other room. And he's like, oh yeah. And he gets up and he cleans it up right then. Okay.
Oh, I love it.
2 weeks later, he comes back to me. He says, Dad, I don't know what's going on, but I can't say no to you anymore. And I'm like, buddy, that's because I'm making you feel good about yourself, you know? And that's the priority. That's the lens I needed to create. That's the context I needed to create from which I asked him something to create that space to do it. He felt good about himself. It was easy to do it then, right? And so demand avoidance, stress, shame, pressure, there's a lot of overlapping elements that are going on here. And I think that's a good example in yours as well about how to work with someone's system, you know?
You know, I think we can all learn, and, you know, it goes for all neurotypes. We can all learn how to be better partners, how to be better friends, how to be better parents. And sometimes, you know, our partner, friend, or child doesn't know what they need. And I love your example with your son, because, you know, even though it may be hard sometimes for those people that we love to accept compliments, and I hear this often, Greg, in the couples group from the autistic partners, I don't take compliments well. You know, it's hard for me to thank my partner when they acknowledge something I did well. And I saw this in my marriage. I would compliment my ex-husband often, and he just, I don't think he knew how valuable his strengths were to me in our life. Because they were strengths, he took them for granted. So if you're the autistic partner and your partner is complimenting you and then asking for your help with something, I do want to please ask you to not think they are trying to manipulate you, because I hear that too. Right? You hear that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I hear this in other ways too, where we'll also kind of intellectualize what we don't like in terms of what's hitting us. And what's hitting us, I think, this is my opinion,
right,
is we're getting hit with a lot of emotions, you know, and what's easy is to protect ourselves from this. You know, suddenly I'm having to soften in this moment. Suddenly I have to feel more about myself and about my relationship. And I think we go to the protective response of walling that off, because that's a default we've had because of emotional intensity all of our lives. And I think that that's part of what happens here, you know. And I've also heard from my couples and my neurodivergent clients that this feels like it's an extra. It feels like they're babying me, you know. That feels like so there's a bunch of reasons why this may be difficult to take in. And it's, again, good to have a framework with to understand what might be going on there, you know?
I think it's really important. And, you know, we've said this before on the podcast, you know, assuming your partner's good intent, I don't think you can really go wrong with that most of the time, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but if you go to that negative because you have trauma, because you've been bullied in the past, because you've been made to look like you were an idiot or wrong or whatever, those are past relationships. Those are people that, hopefully they're not in your life anymore, or you've talked to them and you've worked out, the differences or challenges. Your partner, I will, unless they've got some serious, narcissism or some serious personality disorders or some serious mental health issues, I will bet that your partner has positive intent towards you when they are trying to understand your no response or your lack of a response. And so when I would ask questions, I never was doing it to put my ex on the spot. But I can tell you numerous times he said to me that he felt like he was being put on the spot, that I was grilling him. And he even said to me, "You act like your father." My father was a psychologist. He's passed away almost 20 years ago. And my father used to go into psychologist mode. And my father was autistic, but we didn't know it when he was alive. So he would go into this questioning mode and put on his psychologist hat. And my ex felt like I would go into that role. And it wasn't. That's not what I was doing. I was really trying to understand him, not put him on the spot. But I can see how it felt that I was trying to query him like a lawyer or a psychologist.
All I would say is just amen to the positive assumptions about your partner. We're not trying, like you said, most of us, if not all of us, are not trying to hurt each other. We're struggling to connect and to understand, and we're frustrating. And that's what I seem to find when we get down to things. And again, reemphasize this idea of talking about intent, talking about process, reflecting on experiences and debriefing with your partners is so important, because eventually you got a lot of that good information and your ex was able to tell you, and you're like, if I'd only known, right? And that's part of, also what's become your mission too, which we all appreciate.
And I think, and I appreciate you saying that, because I think if he had felt he could be his authentic self and he felt that his voice mattered, which to me it did, and I wanted him to be his authentic self, but he didn't feel that it was okay. I didn't make it safe enough for him. Or, in his family of origin, it wasn't safe enough. At school, at work, it wasn't safe enough. So he brought that into our marriage. This is the reality. And I know this episode is going to resonate with so many people. And I think it's one of the best episodes we've done, Greg, together. We've talked about so many important things. The unidentified autism, how monotropism can show up in your life, in your relationship, and how it might be connected to that unidentified autism. We've talked about PDA or demand avoidance or demand for autonomy, whatever term you use, and how that can create challenges and understanding what's, beneath all that and how to work through it and create those bridges, as you call that, I think is so critical. And most of what we talk about is intimate relationships, but I know how all of these things can, if we understand them, can benefit all of our relationships with people who are a different neurotype than us. So I think we're at the end, and I want to see if there's anything else that you want to share about any of the topics that we've talked about.
One quick thing, which is, you brought up the monotropic questionnaire, which is online. You can find that online. I also use the ASPE quiz, those two, as informal assessments for my couples and clients, and it can just give you, a possible better lens in terms of understanding, okay, maybe I am on the spectrum, and so this is might be a good resource to use also for the unidentified partners. I right before you said it, Mona, I was thinking the same thing. This might be the best podcast we've ever done. And I have no clue, right? So that says something, you know. So yeah,
go.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And Greg and I are really excited. I talked about a new project that we're doing. I talked about the communication workshop that we did, and I'll put that in the show notes if you're interested in purchasing that. And it comes with the workbook. And we are going to start a support group, and Greg and I are going to co-facilitate that support group. And we still have one or two more podcast episodes we're going to do together. But if you're interested in joining the support group, I will put the link in the show notes, and it's going to start in April, and it's going to be once a month and for about 90 minutes. And it will be for individuals right now, not for couples. But if there's an interest in us having a couple support group, because I think that's a very different dynamic, feel
Yeah.
free to reach out, right? Feel free to reach out to Greg or I. And Greg, you want to give them your email address?
Yeah. Email is G as in, G as in Greg. That's what it is. Thinking of what term? Okay. G Fuqua, which is my last name, first initial last name, G Fuqua 70 at gmail.com. Yeah. Go ahead and reach out to me if you're interested in coaching or need a consultation or a free interview, and love to talk to you.
Yeah, and your website is.
Website is gregfuqua.com.
Okay, awesome. And if you want to email me, it's neurodiverselove, the number four, the letter U at gmail.com. And my website is neurodiverselove.com and has gone through a major update. So the information is just most of the information is still the same, but the website is more user-friendly. So Greg, again, fantastic conversation. Our next episode, I know we're going to talk about alexithymia and emotional differences. And if there are other things that you would like us to talk about, we've had a few folks reach out. So we're looking at those other topics for future episodes. And we hope that some of you will choose to join us for the support group. It's going to be $25, and I'll have more information in the show notes about how you can connect with us and join us for that support group. So, Greg, until next time, thank you so much for such a great conversation.
Thank you. My pleasure.